About 10 years after reshaping the world of wireless video with Teradek, a company whose work earned both technical Academy Awards and Emmys, Nikhil Verhiem turned his attention to space. His new company, TRL-11, is building the end-to-end stack to make spacecraft video native. Radiation-tolerant cameras and optics, edge computers for onboard processing, compression tuned for space, and ground software that turns footage into operational insight. They've shipped product, filed patents on space-specific video software, and partnered with operators across commercial and defense for use cases spanning spacecraft health monitoring, mission awareness, and mission enablement. Today on Valley of Depth, I'm joined by Nikhil, founder and CEO of TRL-11, to go deep on why every spacecraft should carry vision, how edge intelligence transforms video into decisions, and what it takes to build a defensible business at the intersection of cameras, compute, and the growing in-orbit economy. I'm your host, Mo Islam. Let's jump in. Nikhil, welcome to the show.
Hey, Mo. Good to be here.
Thanks for being with us. So I don't want to put an age on you, but I read this previous interview where, you know, you grew up in the 70s and 80s in the era of Star Trek and Star Wars. But I do want to talk a little bit about that just for a second, because I know it was an early inspiration for you. So tell me a little bit about how those two shows were an early inspiration for you, and how did they ultimately shape your sort of passion for engineering and space?
Yeah, so I would actually label it slightly different. Think of it as the post-Apollo era, right? So those movies were inspired by Apollo. And it wasn't just those movies. It was like a ton of TV shows, Battlestar Galactica, you know, Buck Rogers on the Moon, all of that stuff. And so there was this huge enthusiasm about mankind in space. In the era that I grew up, I remember my first stage performance in kindergarten. I was obviously an astronaut, right? That's what everybody wanted to be in the 70s and 80s. And so there was just like a real positive enthusiasm about space. We all believed, I really, truly believed, we were going to have a permanent established moon base before the turn of the century, right? So yes, obviously that influenced my love for space and engineering.
So do you not feel like we have that same level of inspiration in today? What do you think about that?
So officially, if you asked people in the 70s and 80s, young kids, what do you want to be when you grow up? They said an astronaut. Now, if you ask them, they say a YouTube influencer. So it's not quite the same. I think we've met some stark realities of space in the meantime that maybe changed some things. And yeah, it did go slower. We don't have flying cars nor the moon base that we dreamed about. But I think it's also kind of now turning the curve, right? There's now a real enthusiasm for space. Again, we're seeing a lot of new business models now being explored and maybe even closed in space, not just going to the moon.
Got it. So I want to talk about one thing, which is quite unique for the show, which is we've never had a guest who has won an Academy Award and an Emmy. So is it true that you've won both an Academy Award and an Emmy?
It is true. So my company got two of each. I was named on them. And it's important to note, these are technical awards. I'm not an actor or a director or a producer or any of those things. So it's not quite as glamorous. But yes, we were recognized for our contribution. My previous startup, Teradek, really did change the world of content creation. And it's in something that sounds really simple, but it's very difficult. It took a very long time. We removed the cable from the equation. And so that really enabled first Steadicam photography and then eventually drone photography. So drones wouldn't have happened if it wasn't for wireless video. And that's what my company did. And so because we really changed the game, the academies both recognized us.
Wait, so tell us a little bit. We're going to talk about TRL-11, which is a continuation of your work, except now it's within the space industry. But tell us, give me a bit more on Teradek. Like, what was it, your involvement in the business and sort of that life cycle? And yeah, maybe let's start there.
Yeah, so I started Teradek leaving the security and surveillance industry. So I'm an electronic engineer by training, but I always did video in many different industries. And so I saw this opportunity to do wireless video for safety applications. But then we had a big pivot away from security and safety and towards media and entertainment. And it took a long time, but eventually the business was quite successful. I exited to a public company. That became sort of a platform. I did 9 or 10 more acquisitions bolted onto Teradek that then became a whole video platform that was quite successful.
And how did that sort of journey influence the way you kind of thought about starting companies and your company now, TRL11?
If you look at video, basically every industry becomes a video industry eventually, right? I learned there's two types of industries, those that do use video and those that will use video. And eventually, discrete sensors or text-based information turns to pictures and it turns to video. And this happens in every industry, but it's different in every industry. So there's always a fun engineering challenge because, you know, the endoscopic camera is very different than the self-driving car camera, which is different than the camera on my toaster oven. And so they all have unique engineering challenges. And you can sort of just play the same game over and over again when you find a new industry that doesn't yet embrace video. There's a there. There's going to be an opportunity to start a business. So, yeah, I've now participated in 4 startups. This is my 3rd one at the helm as a founder. And I've in all cases, went from a small startup being part of a large company. And so I love video. I'm an electronic engineer through and through. And I like small startups better than large company.
So tell me a little bit more about this kind of evolution from kind of, you know, what looks like a discrete sensor to start to video, and how it applies to the space industry and what problem you're solving with TRL11.
So where do I start? So if you look at our eyes, that's by far the most informative sense that we have into our brains, right? So our brain allocates more volume to store and process the video from our eyes than for all the other senses combined. And that's kind of true in the rest of nature as well. We often see mammals that's very intelligent have very high visual acuity. So that is just the best sensor, and it's always going to be the best sensor. And that's why humans keep on making better and better and better cameras. Maybe stop evolve, you know, something like microphones or speakers. We keep on making better cameras every year. So it's just natural that everything turns into a video industry. And what was interesting to me is space is not there yet. And I couldn't really understand the why from the outside looking in. I was just, okay, space is going to become a video industry. It's not yet. There's an opportunity. And that's when I started TRL11. And the rest was a learning experience. Why is there not more video from space? So we see a lot of launch videos, right? SpaceX does an excellent job of showing us the launch videos. But we don't see a lot of videos from the spacecraft, especially after separation. If you think of your typical transporter launch, you see the rocket, you see the second stage, you see the deployments, and then you don't see video again. And so why is there not more video on each of those deployed spacecraft? That's the problem that I thought I want to contribute, I want to solve. And it turns out there are lots of challenges. In the industry, we call it SWaP-C, size, weight, and power, and cost. And so by the time that you ruggedize the camera to survive in space, it's now heavy, and it's large, and it might cost a lot of money, right? So I think the rumor is the hardened GoPros that Artemis used was more than $1 million each at the end of the day. And then there's the compute power, there's the storage, there's the bandwidth to transmit this video. So that's all luxury if you're a small spacecraft and you don't have all of those resources. And so that's why cameras weren't used before. But all of those things are improving, right? They're all becoming cheaper, or spacecraft cannot carry more load. They have more power. There's always more bandwidth on the horizon. And so that's now clearly saying at some point, it's going to make more sense to use cameras. Because remember, the value of a camera, you know, the bits per second, per watt, per dollar is always going to be more than any other sensor. So the ROI, the information that you get from a camera sensor, is just higher by weight, by dollar, over time than any other methodology.
How should an operator who is, you know, so you mentioned after separation, we typically no longer have video. Why do we need it? Well, what is the problem that you think ultimately there that gets solved by having video?
So it's, you're solving for the unknowns, right? So, or you might even just be creating awareness of emissions. So we see that there's three areas where video can add value. So the first is just health monitoring. You just want to keep an eye on the spacecraft, right? And now, you know, let's say there's something goes wrong, you have a propellant leak. So a pressure sensor might tell you that you have a propellant leak, but only a camera will tell you where the leak is. And so if you remember a while back, there was an anomaly on a SpaceX second stage that was leaking liquid oxygen. They were grounded, Falcon 9 was grounded for a total of 12 days because SpaceX immediately knew exactly where to look for the problem. They tracked it down very quickly to a specific valve that was out of spec. They made an adjustment and just like that, they're back on track, right? And so you can plan with a discrete sensor to measure something and you'll be successful with that. And it will be smaller and lighter, etc. But if something now goes a little bit lopsided and you didn't know what you're supposed to measure, then video is really, really powerful. And so for health insurance, for health monitoring of your spacecraft, health assurance, the video is really perfect. It keeps a good eye on your solar panel, on your propulsion, helps you understand exactly where you're heading, etc. So that's just health monitoring of the spacecraft. Then the second area is just creating mission awareness, right? And this is, again, SpaceX does a really good job of this. You want to show people the excitement of your mission. It's validation, it's proof, but it's more than that. It's very emotional, it's very human. So if you show your little spacecraft deploying, that will probably create support. It will create interest in your mission, whether that's funding or political or even, you know, adversarial in a time of conflict. Video is the ultimate proof point. So that mission awareness is just as important. But then maybe the most interesting one, the hardest one, is mission enablement, where the camera really is the mission, right? And so you cannot perform the mission without the camera. So if, for example, you want to do docking using cameras, so you want to do the relative navigation, acquire object relative navigation, and then maybe grapple or have a docking adapter and then confirm with the camera that docking adapter did exactly what you want. Or maybe space domain awareness. You want to film something in space, maybe do a remote inspection, see what is going on with a specific spacecraft or see what a specific spacecraft is up to. And so for those missions, the camera becomes a really exquisite instrument. And the camera really is the mission.
So if I'm not mistaken, I think you called TRL-11 once as almost like a Nest or Ring camera for space.
It started off like Ring, and it's a good analogy because if you look at Ring, it starts off with a simple camera, the doorbell, right? But then it became a whole ecosystem of devices, lights, other cameras, sensors. And then eventually it becomes an app and a platform behind that too. And so we take that same approach. We don't want to just build cameras. We want to build the full infrastructure for space video. For non-technical people, I call it glass to glass. But for the more technical people, I call it photon to photon. There's a photon coming into the camera, and there's a photon leaving your screen. And we want to touch and add value to everything in between those two photons. So not just the hardware on the spacecraft, the compute, the software, the algorithms, but also on the ground.
Yeah, well, so throughout the show, we'll overlay some of your video imagery so the audience can kind of understand what it is we're talking about exactly. But I do want to talk about this kind of underutilization of video in orbit and why that's the case. Now, you mentioned SWaP-C, and you mentioned weight, and you mentioned cost. And I'm sure power is part of it too, right? Because obviously a lot of these satellites are also power limited in terms of what they can do with their sensors. But is there an element that is pure like awareness where the industry is like, well, you know, it's funny because like as sort of just kind of an outside, let's just say outside looking in, or like sort of the public perception and the view is that video in space is kind of grainy. It's hard to see, right? It's like what you look at videos of Apollo from like the 60s and like the moon missions, you know, it's like, you know, not entirely clear. I mean, yeah, some of the photography is now, especially having, you've seen kind of remastered footage and it looks much better. But I think that's the perception. You know, video in space equals blurry, grainy, not high quality. But that's no longer the case, right? Or hasn't been the case for quite some time. Now we can really put a very high definition camera in space and take very high definition imagery. And I actually remember, and part of the reason for me in inviting you onto the show is I remember you showed me a video of a satellite like whizzing by after like a separation. I believe it was after launch, but I remember thinking it was not real. I was like, yeah, this looks like a rendering. But you were like, no, this is a video.
Yeah. So every single pixel in that video was real. There was no trickery in there. But that is
we'll play that video as we discuss.
It's a very typical response because people associate science fiction, you know, rendering Star Wars like video with fake, and then they assume the real stuff is all black and white and it's super grainy and it might be a low frame rate. And it's certainly not human visually appealing. It in many cases, it looks like an instrument. But it's no longer necessary for us to really choose between those extremes. We can have both, right? The cameras got so good. The Swapsy is affordable. And there's just insights that comes from video, right? I really like that word so much because think about this. I could make a comment like, do you see what I mean? Can you see what I'm saying? And so, of course, you can't see what I'm saying. You don't see the little words coming out of my mouth, but you visualize, you internalize by visualizing something, and then you get insight, right? And so I really see that somewhere in future, spacecrafts will have insight, will become aware of their surroundings, and it will be mostly informed by video. I'm really excited about that future.
So, okay. So tell us about the actual products that you're building today. What does TRL, actually, first of all, what is TRL 11? What does that mean? Maybe talk about that first.
It started off as a joke, obviously. We all know technology readiness level only goes to 9. And so it's very bold and cocky to say, we're going to call the company TRL 11. So it was a bit of an inside joke. Actually, homage to the book Liftoff that tells the story of, I think it was Falcon 1 Flight 3 that solved the first 10 problems and then the 11th one was the problem. So always go to 11. There's a Spinal Tap reference in there as well. But we kind of realized that it's actually not a joke. It's actually a mission. It's actually really tells the story of what we do. In that, we didn't invent cameras in space. We're hardly the first ones to try that. But we just want to take it further, right? So there's a specific partnership opportunity that we have now that it's really exciting because we work with people that's absolute, you know, heroes in space, in science, that's taken stuff to TRL 9. And now we get to take it further. So they design something, they build it, they model it, they simulate it, they work decades on something. They put it in space, they prove it works, and then what? We then take it further by productizing it, by taking out costs, by making it whatever, easier to integrate, easier to use. And now it becomes something that's far more available to the rest of the industry. It's not just this once-off exotic instrument. It's now actually a product with a short lead time and a reasonable swapsy, right? And so I kind of feel, in a way, keep in mind the TRL scale, I think, was designed in the 70s, right? And so 9 at that point was what NASA could see as the ultimate state, the end game of something in space. But clearly that expectations have changed, right? We've moved the bar on. And so really now I think it should go to 20, not just to 9. And we're just the first people to see that. So we picked TRL 11.
So what exactly are the products that you're offering to market today?
Okay. So we want to offer the full infrastructure to make video from space possible, live video or file-based playback video. But we offer all of the pieces that's necessary. Just like Ring offers from the camera to the app, we do the same. We offer optics, cameras for space, We offer edge computers that can do a lot of recording and a lot of machine vision algorithms in there. The algorithms can be used, for example, to navigate, can do anomaly detection, what I mentioned earlier, or it can be used to do navigation, not just start tracking, but also limb finding. So solving for where you're looking, where you are, and even when you are from machine vision. That's all informed by cameras. And then we recognize that the video exposure, video compression, the machine vision, it's all slightly different, or in some cases very different in space than it is on the ground. So we have a lot of our own compression algorithms. We have our own video transmission stack that sends it to the ground. And then on the ground, we have our own visualization that basically offers you hyper-realism. So let's say I want to, the shadows on my spacecraft is really distracting me, and I can't see this little leak, which is what I should be focused on. So we can distract the parts of the mission that's not important, even though it's visually appealing. It's fun to watch. We can extract that, and we can emphasize the parts of the mission that is really important, like the little leak. So we offer hardware for the spacecraft, cameras and edge computers, and then a lot of software, both on the spacecraft, but also the transmission protocols and the software on the ground. And ultimately, we see that this could be a mission commander environment that's primarily using video.
What is the, I want to dig into this idea of like, where we only kind of focus on what you might need to see in any given situation. If there's like, for example, a problem, what does that mean in practice? Does that mean you are feeding video to an operator that where you're, you know, for lack of a better word, blurring out all the things that don't matter and focusing in on the things that do? Like, what does that look like in practice?
Yeah. So we can do that. We might mask it by just darkening it somewhat. And then put a red box around the area that is of real importance, of real interest to you. The key thing that we realized when starting to do space video is there's so much movement in space. Because of the station keeping of a satellite that's in orbit, you always have these shadows that's moving over the spacecraft, and they really define really harsh shadows. It's not, we don't have the diffused look that we have on Earth. And then obviously if the Earth is in the frame, you see the Earth turning below you, and who's not intrigued to watch the Earth and try and see, ooh, where, that's California, that's where I live, right? So what we realized is humans, and by extension, the video compression that we developed, is naturally drawn to movement, as if movement is really informative for you, as if there's net new important information just because it's moving, right? Which makes a lot of sense. That's how we evolved. We evolved with our feet on the ground. We can't fly. We can't really run very fast either. So movement tend to be a big deal for us. And so if you were to analyze what does the eyes and the eagle look like, it's very different. How they process only the movement within the movement. And so we did a similar thing for space video. We basically find a way to see this movement as according to plan. So ignore that, but this other movement is not according to plan, so focus on that. So we can't only look at the change detection in one direction, in successive frames. We also have to look at it relative to what we expected to happen. If the Earth turns, then we can remove all of that information. The fact that we're flying over Italy, the coastline of Italy hasn't changed in a million years, so we don't want to describe the coastline of Italy using precious bandwidth. But we do want to describe that little piece of smoke coming out of Mount Etna that is now maybe not according to plan. It wasn't known to us, right? That's new. So it's almost counter. Sometimes the most informative part might not be moving, but it mustn't be there. And so you want to highlight that. And so we started doing this thinking it's all about saving bandwidth. We want to be able to do better video compression so that we can send higher frame rate video, even if we don't have good bandwidth from the satellite. But then we realized the real benefit is actually better insights, quicker insights by drawing the human's attention to what is not according to plan. That's more valuable than saving the bandwidth in the end.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I want to ask a little bit a question around moat. So I understand sort of the moat around, like, let's just say a compression algorithm, or maybe what you're doing on, you know, the machine learning, machine vision side, especially as you're describing about, you know, the sort of the movement within the movement. But as far as the actual hardware goes, like a camera, like what is, how big of a competitive moat is it to have and like produce the cameras that you're producing? Like obviously they're radiation hardened, they're built for space, but can anyone go and do that? Like how do you think about that?
So just building a space camera, that is not a very moaty business. In a way, anybody can do that. You can start with an off-the-shelf camera and you can harden it, and you'll do a ton of testing before you get it just right. So it will take a while and it will be expensive, but yeah, that in itself is not a moat. What I think is the moat is looking really into that video and really understanding what is of value for this specific industry, right? So the video that the self-driving car looks at is very different than the video in my toaster oven, which is different than the video in an endoscopy camera, right? And so understanding what the actual video tells us in space and then building the software stack about that, I think that's more exciting. And that's also areas where you can now, there's a number of things that we are quite sure we are first to do that. And so that's where we can patent the technology. So we already have two patents that is about the software in space, specifically enhancing space-based video.
Can you share what you've learned in your early kind of in orbit tests?
I already covered a little bit of it. We realized, hey, space video is really exciting, but it's also not that informative until you figure out what this is the part that I should have looked at. So I'll give you an example. So in one of our first missions, we recorded 90 minutes of video, but we only managed to download about 7 seconds of it before the spacecraft unfortunately died. And so it haunted me for a long time. Why did we download that 7 seconds and not that other 7 seconds, right? And so that's where we realized, okay, what we should do is do some processing on board to quickly figure out what is the most interesting video and then prioritize that, download that first. So that's where our product name, VIP First, came from. It's short for the very important pictures first. We wanted to do edge processing to figure out what is the important part of the mission and download that first. So VIP First then was also applied on a frame-by-frame basis. So that became the very important pixels only, VIP only. And then eventually we realized this can go on and on and on, so we should just find a generic way of looking at this, and it became the video intelligence platform. And so obviously, it's not just the video that we learned. There's so much more about the industry that we had to learn. I've done video for decades, but I didn't know that much about space. I had an earlier stint in aerospace, but this was quite different. All the environmental testing that goes into space and why vacuum is so hard, actually getting rid of the heat and vacuum was a surprising lesson for us. We could see vibration, we could see radiation, but I didn't realize electronics is going to overheat, and the ways in which they overheat in vacuum is actually really fascinating. I learned about rapid unscheduled disassembly. We had a couple of those ourselves, but don't tell the landlord. And yeah, it's a great learning experience. It's a fun industry.
Can you tell us a little bit about the types of customers, your primary kind of initial customers, commercial versus, you know, defense, DOD? Clearly, there's an obvious use case for putting a camera and pointing it at an adversary's spacecraft getting high resolution imagery there. But like, tell us a little bit about the types of customers you're working with now and how you see that evolve over time.
Yeah. So when we started, we were really just focused on this health monitoring aspect. And we thought that commercial space was on the up and up and there's going to be lots of opportunities there. So something like on-orbit refueling, the sensor that's involved in that. We saw that commercial was where the fun is going to be. But over time, that really did change. And I think I'm not alone in this. A lot of the industry have realized, okay, actually, maybe defense is really where it's at. So we sold some of these health monitoring cameras to commercial, but then over time, we migrated most of our efforts. It's more of a defensive nature, particularly space domain awareness from space-based sensors, RPO, whether that's for docking, so rendezvous proximity operations, whether it's for docking or for space domain awareness, remote inspecting, and then self-awareness, ownership awareness, not just about your own ship in itself, but your immediate environment and then even larger environment around you, right? So you probably know space is becoming much more congested. Everybody knows that, but it's also becoming much more contested. And there's a real urgency there that our adversaries have noticed that we have assets in space that is critical, not just for our defense, but even for our economy. And so if our adversaries now develop the capability to attack those assets, that makes the people in the Pentagon quite nervous. And so there's definitely a sense of urgency around space domain awareness. I was in Maui 2 weeks ago for the AMOS convention. General Saltzman said, we must move away from this world of a potpourri of sensors and get to real understanding quicker, right? And so that really spoke to me, because getting that insight ultimately means the decision maker needs to see something in a format that he can quickly come to the right conclusion and quickly make a decision, right? So if you think of a control room all the way back to the Apollo days, there's people sitting there with slide rulers and lots and lots and lots of numbers. But the simple reality is we're not spreadsheets with legs. We're cameras with legs, right? And so we really see stuff. We really understand stuff when we see it in a way that is natural to us. And so if the general has to make a decision, you don't want to show him a bunch of TLEs updating in a graph and say, hey, this was an RPO maneuver. You want to actually visualize it and show him in a language that he understands. So we see that there's a big shift to space becoming quite a defensive opportunity.
So I'm going to put my investor hat on for just a second. Can you tell me a little bit about how do you size this market, right? Because maybe some people say, okay, video in space makes sense, valuable for the whole host of reasons that we talked about today. But is this a large scalable market? Like, what does that look like? I mean, how do you talk about that with investors?
It's a thorn in my side. And I feel for the VCs that has to do that analysis, because it is really difficult. Unless you're basically asking hypothetical questions of real futurist type people, how do you size something that doesn't exist yet, right? There's not going to be any data that's backing it up. The first thing that I think is really important is recognize that unlike, say, the European economy of old, that was a finite resources, in which case it was a zero-sum game, right? So for anything to gain, it had to come at the cost of something else. That's sort of how land worked in Europe hundreds of years ago, right? But when we moved to the West and we discovered the US, you could have five tobacco farmers right next to each other, and they could just keep on expanding their land and keep on producing more and more tobacco to send back to Europe without actually taking land from each other. So it changed from a zero-sum game to an infinite resources game. And so that's sort of the story of the US, and it became even more so the story the further west we moved, right? And then it became even more so when we found the internet, and it's going to be even more so if we now really start exploring space, because it's really, truly infinite, right? So the first thing to recognize is it can become very, very big. I'm not saying it will, I'm not saying it will happen quickly, but the sky is no longer the limit. Space is really infinite. So it can become massive. And so if I put my futurist hat on, I will simply say, we all know that Earth is a very small part of space, not the other way around. So the Earth economy in time will be a small part of the overall economy. So a lot of economic activity will move into space. That's in the passage of time, that's unavoidable. And we already see that. And that's really exciting, right? We now see telecoms, 5G, direct to device from space. That was a dream when I started the business. Now it's a reality, right? SpaceX just paid a ton of money to buy spectrum to do just that, right? If you look at AST SpaceMobile's share price, that it's now becoming real. It's no longer a dream. The next thing I believe is going to be energy. I'm really excited about the number of startups that's now basically saying they'll do sunlight on demand from space or solar power from space. Those business models are starting to close, and then eventually we'll need a service economy to support all of those, right? So right now we don't have a AAA, we don't have a Jiffy Lube, we don't have a tow truck, any of those things in space. But it will become necessary as that economy kind of burps into life. And obviously, a lot of that will be unmanned robotics, and that will require a lot of cameras and a lot of cool video. So I'm really excited about where it can go. It can become massive and infinitely large. The question is when, right? We don't know. But I'll just kind of land the plane on this. So think back of, I know for a fact that BlackBerry said no to really cool touchscreen technology. And I think Microsoft had a touchscreen phone before Apple did, right? And so if you ask people in 2005, what's the market for touchscreen technology for phones, the answer would have been, it's pretty small. It's not exciting. It's not venture backable. But 2 years later, everybody wanted it. So I'm hoping that that's true for space as well.
Do you think every spacecraft should have a video on board?
I think so. I like I said before, if you look at the bits per second of information, the valuable insights that you get per gram or per dollar, cameras will always win, right? And so think of it this way. Tesla famously gave up on LIDAR or radar sensor, sonar, whatever, doubled down just on visual cameras. That was mostly an economical decision. So those other sensors have certain benefits. They can see through dense fog, right? But we can't, and we make for perfectly good drivers by ourselves. So if you actually look at the value that you can get out of a camera on your spacecraft versus the cost versus the swap, I really believe every spacecraft should have a camera, and they should, all of those cameras should work to get insights, to have awareness. It's not just you start with vision, then you go to perception, and then you eventually get awareness, right? So I think every spacecraft should have awareness of itself and of its surroundings using cameras.
Let's talk a little bit, just kind of tie it back to something we talked about from the very beginning, which is this idea of kind of inspiration. And, you know, I would argue that if we, you know, landed on the moon and we didn't have a video camera present, would it have been as inspirational? Probably not, right? Like, well, first of all, most people wouldn't have believed it to begin.
I haven't checked recently, but I think I'm still right. The most watched live broadcast event ever was Apollo 11 landing on the moon. That's still the case 50 some years later. And so the excitement, the inspiration that came from watching that, again, in that language that we all understand, is just unparalleled. So quite recently, spacecraft successfully landed on the moon. Or maybe landed sideways, but they made it there, they landed, they survived. They broadcast telemetry back. It was really unexciting to watch people in a control room say, based on the telemetry, we can confirm the spacecraft landed on the moon. It just wasn't
inspiring. This is the intuitive machines mission, I think, you're referencing.
So, I mean, it's such a success. We want to celebrate it. We want to see it in a medium that is as natural to us, that is so part of the human experience. And so I definitely long for the days where we can do a live transmission back from the moon of humans running around with little cameras, right, from Mars, maybe even, you know, one day, not sure if that will be in our lifetimes, but from Europa, right? And so just imagine how cool would it be if you could actually see live humans discovering alien remnants or alien life, right? Would you, you don't want to just read about it. You don't want to just see telemetry feeds of it. You want to see the video.
What do you think is the most, from your conversations with customers and investors and partners, like what do you think they misunderstand the most? If there's anything that like kind of sticks out to you.
So I think people underestimate the utility that you can get from cameras. And in other words, how much value it can do, how much value it can add to the mission. So we all know star trackers, right? But that star tracker should not only detect where you're looking, but it should also be able to detect, is your spacecraft healthy? And it should even be able to detect where you are. And so it takes extra processing, and it might need a larger field of view or a longer telescope, a smaller field of view. But there's so much more that cameras can do than the limited uses that we used cameras in space for in the past, right? So I really think there should be lots of cameras in every spacecraft. They should always be on, and they should always be harvesting information that informs you, that gives you insight.
Just in terms of company building, I mean, you've built Teradek, now TR-11. Any lessons that you've learned just kind of working in the space industry?
Yeah, space is an interesting one. I love this journey of starting businesses, building the thing that builds the thing, right? So building the organization, and whether that's the team or the factory or the pipeline of products or inventory that's necessary, the partnerships that's comes along the way. I really enjoy that process, particularly the team part of it. But most startups get away with learning those lessons through experimentation, right? So fail fast. In space, it's difficult because the cost of failure, the how long it takes and how much it costs and maybe the implications of failure is unacceptable. You can't experiment quite the same way that you would if you were a SaaS business, right? Trying to get clicks on a cat video and experimenting relentlessly on that is okay, but you can't experiment with spacecraft the same way. So it is hard. So I've been in startups many, many years now. This one is different. The people are just an order of magnitude harder working, smarter, risk takers, brave people, and you must be able to persevere even if the mission goes lopsided. So it's a good industry. If you can make it here, then you're certainly worth something.
How are you guys financed so far, and are you raising any external funding or financing anytime soon?
Yeah. So we did a pre-seed round, just over $5 million early on in the business. And we used that to do some on-orbit demonstrations and then to develop the original technology stack. But then we actually, being a bootstrapper, you can't keep a good bootstrapper down. We started making money. We started selling product. That was important to me because I really did want to validate that there is a business, that there is a there, that we can make the products, you know, with margin and in the volumes that is necessary to make it a business. So we did not pursue a seed round like most people would do shortly following the pre-seed. We instead focused on actually growing the business. And so we built some really good partnerships there with companies like Vast or Starfish Space that helped us a lot, not just financially, but they helped us understand what are the actual requirements of the product, what is the conops that people can use to gain from this. And so the business was sort of chugging along happily, making a little bit of money, breaking even, growing slowly. And that would have been a perfectly good lifestyle business, except now we did see opportunity to really accelerate the business and to grow it into something that is really massive. And so now we are going back and raising more capital externally. And this, it's all about accelerating opportunity that's just around the horizon. That is about space domain awareness for defensive applications.
Got it. And then I guess my final question, what's this legacy that you want to leave with TRL-11? Like, is this like a future scenario where you have astronauts in space, you know, taking videos of each other, and then when you zoom in, you see TRL-11 on the side of the camera? Like, what does that look like long-term for you? And is there another product out this sort of, my favorite part about talking to space companies, and some of this is out of necessity, sometimes it's out of just like, you know, like going after a bigger and bigger market, but it's interesting to see how products evolve from what they are today, or companies evolve, I should say, from the product they sell on day one versus the product they sell on, you know, day 365. So I just curious, like, you know, talk about legacy, talk a little bit about product evolution and like where you see the business in like 10 years.
Yeah, it's interesting. So the reality of business, if a business becomes large, you have the classic innovator's dilemma, you can't experiment, you can't innovate as quick as a small company, right? So a lot of the brands that we now know as large video platforms, YouTube, Netflix, Skype, or you know, Ring, Nest, GoPro, all of these brands, they were all small startups at one point. They were not products that was designed in the large incumbent. And so I would love for TRL 11 to become the platform for space video, really solving everything in between the two photons. And if we do it right, we see that it can become like telepresence. It can be as if you're there, and that can unlock a lot of new mission areas, right? So if we can operate a remote control arm on the moon just as well as we can a remote control surgeon can control his robot, there's a lot of exciting new things that we can do that way. So if we can achieve the end-to-end platform that gives telepresence to space, that would be pretty cool. Separately, if humans go back to the moon, I would love to live stream that. If humans go to Mars, or if we do a flyby of an asteroid with a close call to Earth, or maybe even an interstellar interloper, I would want to be involved in making that possible. I think that would be a pretty good bookend for someone working in video, is to do video, live video from a once in a lifetime occurrence like that.
Amazing. Well, Nicol, I hope that happens. There's not too many companies like yourself that I'm certainly aware of. So, you know, it would be when we do that live stream from the moon, you know, it better be your camera doing it. So
I hope so. We're going to make it happen.
Thanks for being with us, Nicol. Really appreciate it. It's a really interesting story, and excited to see how it develops.
Thanks, Mo. It was great to be here.